wait to call her back again today and see how she's feeling, because this is just an astounding victory for her and the many other people like her who've been involved in this effort.
I mean, a Democratic governor is in office in Kansas, though the state voted Trump won by something like more than 15% in 2020. But the counties that passed this were many more than those who voted for the Democratic governor. I mean, what an amazing sign for things to come, and close to a million people voting. We've never seen anything like this, as you said, in a primary. Finally, what does this mean for the message for the November elections, where there are other constitutional amendments being voted on, like in Michigan?
Right. I mean, I think we saw signs of this with Michigan. I mean, Michigan organizers, grassroots organizers, reproductive justice groups in Michigan managed to get a tenth of the state's population to sign on, almost a million people to sign on to an effort to put a sweeping protection for reproductive freedom to the voters in the November election. There's similar measures to enshrine reproductive freedom in California and Vermont coming up. So I think we're likely to see even more ballot initiatives aimed at expanding abortion access, because I think voters in Kansas have just proven that the will of the people can be a powerful tool to overrule the will of a Republican-dominated legislature.
Amy Littlefield, thanks so much for joining us. Journalist covering reproductive health care, abortion access correspondent for The Nation, former producer for Democracy Now! That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tarina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, I'm Amy Goodman.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives, cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me, the Bill of Rights throws me in jails, they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and they paw me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light.
And good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO, coming at you out of inner southeast Portland. That was our opening song, Willie Dunn, one of the, I guess you'd say, early sort of a new wave folk singer, protest singers, indigenous in Canada. And the reason I'm playing him is because actually, that song came out just about 50 years ago now, and kind of at the time when my guess dad and I think probably still grandfather were very active in colonial resistance, anti-colonial resistance in Canada, which we're going to be talking about this morning with Canada's Freedom Manuel. Good morning.
Good morning.
So does that song bring up anything for you in particular?
Well... it just reminds me of the country music that I was raised on from my father, Arthur Manuel, a late father, Arthur Manuel, who's passed on now. But yeah, I was raised on country music, and he liked to play music, especially that native singers sang. And he actually played the guitar too, so, and he played country music as well. So yeah, it resonated with me. Thank you.
Uh-huh. And yeah, I was going... going back and looking at some of your history and your family history, very illustrious family history, which you're carrying on. And I'll let you talk about that some, in addition to obviously what you're doing now and what you've been doing in the, gosh, it's 7 years, I think. There's a flurry of activity. You were here, I think, a couple times back in 2015 when there was a whole lot going on. You were, I know, invited to a panel at Portland State University, and then I believe the Resistance Ecology Conference. That was a time of great activity around anti-fossil fuel infrastructure movements and such. Anyway, so yeah, you've been very busy, I see, since. But yeah, why don't you just go ahead and like introduce yourself, where you're from, and your family before we get into it.
Okay, thank you. My name is Karahus Manuel. People know me also as Karahus Freedom. I'm a Sahuatmokan Tanaka indigenous person, mother of four, from up in so-called British Columbia, Canada. We call our territory Sahuatmok Uluh, the Sahuatmok Nation. And I am the granddaughter of Dr. Grand Chief George Manuel, and I'm the daughter of the late Arthur Manuel, both political leaders and international leaders for our rights and our title as Indigenous people. I'm a proud mother of four freedom babies. I raised them out of the system, not registering them with the Canadian government or birth certificates, or really pushed myself and to decolonize as much as I can to raise my children. And I have four. Our territory is 180,000 square kilometers of land that we've never signed treaties for, so our land remains unceded and unsurrendered to this day. I've been involved in several land conflicts regarding our Sahuatmok title and rights and our self-determination to our land and hunting grounds, including the Santique Ski Resort. And I was named in an injunction and arrested multiple times fighting for this mountain and Skokwakwolt. And right before I visited what you mentioned in 2015, what happened a year prior on August 4th of 2014 was one of North America's largest mine tailings disasters that happened in the heart of our territory in Yuxmasen Chaimetqua, one of the greatest and most magnificent lakes, as it refers to the spilling of the breaking of a woman's water when she gives birth. That's how significant this lake was. The deepest glacier flood lake in the world, that Imperial Metals Mount Polly mine disaster unleashed billions of gallons of mine waste, the earthen dam collapsed and just unleashed all of that into our creeks and our, and this magnificent lake that was a part of is a part of the Fraser River watershed, which provides 2/3 of the province of so-called British Columbia, one of the biggest watersheds. And so now we're facing off with Trans Mountain Pipeline, one of the biggest North American pipeline expansion projects that are happening right now, from the Alberta tar sands, and 1,000-kilometer pipeline pumped all the way to Burnaby Mountain out near Vancouver and the inlets around Vancouver and Tsleil-Waututh territory. And so this pipeline is one of the biggest fights that we're facing right now, because it's one of the biggest threats to our water and to our land, since it cuts and bisects right through the middle of our territory, Sahuatmok Uluh. And just recently, we had a visit here to our land from the Pope, and which caused a lot of controversy and got a lot of Native people up in arms and everything. But I'm sure we're going to elaborate on that later. And yeah, I'm sitting here at Tiny House Warriors, how we've been here for 4 years. Tiny House Warriors is a mission to stop Trans Mountain Pipeline, and we're building tiny houses on wheels and deploying them in parts of our territory to assert our title and our jurisdiction to the land, and to use this as our direct action method to bring attention to this illegal pipeline that's being constructed without Indigenous consent through our territory. And so I'm sitting here, there's 6 tiny houses here, and we're just preparing for some big gatherings that are coming up. So just been busy these last couple of days and into this whole month. But I'm glad that you invited me here because I have a lot to share, and specifically, you know, regarding us as Indigenous people and being, you know, pushed to the very fringes of society. We're losing our people to overdoses and the fentanyl crisis, where there's more children in the foster care system than at the height of residential school. So our Native children are still being taken at such exacerbated rates, like, than any other children in all across Canada. And meanwhile, so-called British Columbia has the most starving children. We have the highest poverty and hungry kids than the rest of Canada. So, and we come from the most luscious parts of this so-called country. We come from so much water. And so just like to also mention that I'm a twin. I'm a twin. I have an identical twin sister, Mayuk Manuel. She's a GIS mapper, and she's mapped the water within our nation. She's mapped the water that the pipeline is threatening to cross, and the maps are just full of blue. Some of these creeks and streams only last when the snowpacks are melting, so they'll last like 4 or 5 months out of the year. So some of them are temporary. Even once you remove the temporary creeks, or the ones that are just the snow runoff, the map is still blue. When you look at it, it just looks like a blue map. That's how much water we have coming from our land. And people don't want to realize the same water that's here is the same water that was here when the dinosaurs are here. We're not inventing new water. You can't clean all this water to purity like it was once. We actually could go to the creek and we could actually get down on our hands and knees and drink the water.
As we could right here where I'm speaking, and everywhere before this mad colonial industrial process inserted itself into the landscape. But so you mentioned the Pope, and we will talk about that. I guess I did want to backtrack and say that is the original reason I reached out to you when Pam Palmater was on Democracy Now, I believe last week, during the Pope's visit. She was on for, I don't know, 5-10 minutes, and she kept wanting to talk about, or my interpretation, I'll have to go back and listen to it, was she kept wanting to talk about the doctrine of discovery, which is the legal fiction that became sort of the basis for the justification for the colonization of America and the rest of the world. And it seemed like the host didn't really pick up on it. And so anyway, I reached out to her, and I didn't actually hear back, and I reached out to you, and here you are. And we will be talking about that. I did notice, along those lines, an article I just pulled up. One of your band members, actually, Judy Wilson, is in an article. And the Secretary-Treasurer of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs actually mentioned, seems to be there's a sort of an increasing call upon the Pope to renounce this doctrine of discovery. And it's unclear exactly what actual effect that would have, but it's obviously a would be a big symbolic effect, because it did, you know, it basically gave the sort of a carte blanche to the European Christian nations to assert their rights under God to all lands of the, you know, the pagans, infidels, whatever. And some of them were even stronger language that, you know, they were could kill, kidnap, or whatever, anybody they wanted to. And anyway, so that was, you know, and it did get incorporated certainly into United States federal Indian law with some major Supreme Court decisions. I'm less familiar with Canada. But anyway, that is something interesting. Can you just maybe talk a little bit about that? And then we can, you know, talk about the reason for the Pope's visit, the residential schools. But do you see that as significant significant campaign around the doctrine of discovery?
Yes, I know it's important, and it's crucial for us to, you know, educate people about how these colonial countries and governments even got foot within our territory. And my father, Arthur Manuel, he went to law school, and we were raised with family sermons at our kitchen table for hours, him talking about the political plight for our people. And he would tell us, my first day at law school, they taught us about legal fiction, and that this whole country is based off of legal fiction. And he talked about terra nullius. And so sitting there, he would verse us on what these words meant. And prior to him passing away, he organized a symposium at the Thompson Rivers University in Kamloops about the doctrines of discovery. And to explain like how the basis of this is the papal bull, and how the church is involved in the theft of our land, and how the government of Canada still lives by it and upholds it by just their occupation of our territories. That's their whole explanation behind it, to excuse away their occupation of our lands, is by using this legal fiction of the doctrines of discovery, that the lands were empty and it was free for the taking for the Christian people and for the church. And so this is what Canada is living on today. So what would it mean if they rescinded it? Well, let's push, let's find out, because it's the outdated, racist, white supremacist mentality that needs to get thrown in the garbage. You know, it's an actual paper document, too, that needs to be thrown out forever, and we need to, as Indigenous people, take control of our own territories. We need to manage our own territories, because we're going to do it better than anyone else. We've done it for thousands and thousands of years prior to any type of colonial contact or European contact. We've looked after our land, and we're going to be able to do it again. And that's why we stand out here to assert our rights and title, because this is wrong. This doctrines of discovery and what's now being called the doctrines of domination is wrong. It's outdated. It's racist. It's white supremacist and it's whole thought. And people need to see that clearly, that that's the basis of why they're even occupying Indigenous territories all throughout North America, South America, the world. They've used this same thing to take control of land.
Yeah, the colonial system established itself all around the world. England in the forefront, but of course France and Belgium and the other ones got in on the bandwagon as well. Anyway, Portugal, Spain, yeah. And so yeah, you mentioned that you didn't register your children, and that really struck me in the context of the. You know, the Pope came to Canada because there's been a lot of pressure on him, because, you know, the Catholics and all the other denominations had their own, I don't know about all of them, but most of them, certainly the mainline ones, had their own residential schools where they basically stole Indigenous youth from their families, from their communities, by force often. Obviously, some gave them up because they didn't want to be forced and into these residential schools. I mean, you can talk about it. I think your father himself was went to a residential school, I believe. And so I just, it really struck me that you didn't register. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what that means as a political act, and what it, you know, what, if there are any consequences for that action.
Okay. Yeah, my father, he went to Kamloops Indian Residential School, and my grandfather, George Emmanuel, went to Kamloops Indian Residential School, which is in Suquamish territory. It's around 2 hours from where I am calling right now, from Blue River. And but it's really close to my home community and reservation of Nisqually Indian Reservation. And that's where I was raised. That's where my father and my grandfather were raised as well, they were actually raised in residential school. My father went to St. Eugene's Mission and St. Mary's residential school too, so he actually went to three residential schools. And they made it law here in Canada, if you didn't send your children to residential school, it wasn't all nice for the first generations. It was by force, it was by the use of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to assert this this new law for the children to be forced into these residential schools. By that time, the Indian reservation system was already in effect, which we call the concentration camps. And the church, the RCMP, the law, the government, all involved in collaborating to force this genocide on our people and force them to residential school. And the reason why I don't speak my language fluently to this day, my grandfather, he continued to speak this language, and he died still speaking his language. And my father never spoke his language. He actually had to go to language teachers, my auntie, to help write speeches in Suquamish Jeans so he can go recite it and speak it to the elders. Like, he tried hard to learn language in his life after the residential school. And it was a genocide. It was a genocide that happened to completely eliminate us as Indigenous people, as Suquamish people. My grandfather, as a leader, he would always say that our language, it flows from our land. Our culture flows from the land. You can't separate the land from us. You can't force us onto a reservation and then the other 180,000 square kilometers of our land we don't use, but that's not going to affect us. We depend on that whole amount of territory to be who we are as Suquamish people. Our huckleberries, our moose, our caribou, our salmon spawning grounds, our everything in our whole territory that we depend on is linked to our food and our sustenance to continue to practice who we are as Native people. So by the time it was my time to fight, and I was a Native youth movement, and then I had my first child, had conceived my first child, and I was with Native Youth Movement. That's who I was, my family was too at that time. And there was another lady, her name is Elena. She's from Chilap, Statliam, from the next nation over. And she was pregnant as well. And she said, there's some Native sovereignists, they don't register their babies. And it was down in Leetwat in the Mount Currie area, close to Pemberton, Whistler area. And it's just all know where that is, natives there, and they didn't register, and there was three generations that never registered.
And what does it mean to register?
Register meaning register with the government. Because you go to the hospital usually, and someone gives you a paper, register your child to that they're a part of British Columbia, that they're part of Canada. But what they were teaching was saying, hey, we don't want to be wards of the state. We don't want to be wards of Canada. We want to be free like our ancestors. Our ancestors never had to have documentations to exist. Pretty well, you're just surrendering your baby to the crown by getting documents from the crown. And there was a whole movement of people, women, that refused to do that. And it inspired me. It inspired me, and they start calling these babies freedom babies. They weren't born in the hospital, and they didn't get any type of white man's documentation to say they existed. Mm-hmm. That also means you can't get government help for your baby either. So that was a big thing, that because Canada leaves Indigenous people in such an impoverishment because they've taken away all of your land. You know, if you add up all the Indian reserves in Canada, it will equal 0.2%. So not even 1% of our original land do we have control of. Even on the reserve level, the Crown still owns that. That's a federal Indian concentration camp. My number is 690 for my band. You know, so I never wanted to participate in that. I never wanted to take my baby, born from me, put that baby into the hands of the crown for them to write my child down like a number and document that child's birth to the ownership of the crown. No, I wanted to have my baby free without any type of colonial or white man interference with my baby. And so I had four children like that. Mm-hmm. And I had them in very spiritual, sacred sites amongst my nation, and it was purposeful what mountain I birthed them on. And I learned hard and intensely everything I could about traditional midwifery and the health of women, labor, birth, and postnatal, and the care of the baby. I learned everything I can from our traditional knowledge keepers about motherhood and labor and everything. And I even traveled down to the jungles of Central America to learn from midwives. I went and sought midwives anywhere I could, and I learned as much as I can, actual decades, so I can birth my babies on the land and not have any type of fear of that. And my husband at the time, the father of all four of my children, sent him off to learn medicine, and he went to go learn medicine from medicine people and traditional Chinese medicine doctors and acupuncture doctors, and so he can learn this knowledge, because our goal is to have our villages free out in the mountains and have no contact with anybody. We still have territory large enough for that, but mm-hmm. we have to retain all of that knowledge that was like beat out of us at the Indian residential schools, and all that knowledge that was killed out of us during the epidemics and smallpox and the influenza that just decimated sometimes 95% of our villages. So we lost a lot of medicine men, a lot of midwives, a lot of expert knowledge with the deaths during those, that biological warfare that the Canadian government, you know, waged against us, the Hua'uk. And so now we are in a state where we have around 10,000 Tsuhuatmukh existing on this planet. There's 10,000 of us strong. And we have language speakers and teachers within our movements that we continue to invite up here on the front line, so we can continue to learn the language in order to fight. There's different languages, right? Like language to hunt, you become expert with those type of words pertaining to hunting. Well, we have language pertaining to resistance and fighting and waiting, asserting our sovereignty and self-determination. When they're the first words that anyone that ever approaches our barricades will hear, Sahuatmukh Ching.
Mm-hmm.
And so still decolonizing every day, even while we're fighting one of these biggest pipelines, you know, one of Canada's biggest pipelines right now.
Yeah, I'd like to, we'll talk a little bit more about that. Obviously, the people, our listeners are very familiar with anti-pipeline fights, since we covered heavily the Dakota Access Pipeline struggle in which erupted actually just after you visited here in 2015, started in 2016, became a major flashpoint, major movement. I'm not sure if you were there or participated in that, but I do want to reintroduce you, Canahus Manuel, who's speaking to us from up in occupied Sequepemc territory. And is with us for the hour until 9 o'clock. I'm Paul Rowland, the host of Wednesday Talk Radio. We have just about a half an hour left. This is a call-in show, so if you'd like to get in your question, comment to Canahus, the number is 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. One thing that people who have touched base with, who've read about, studied, been involved with indigenous anti-colonial struggles will notice is that there's, like anything else, there's sort of these waves of activism. Obviously, the first wave was the colonial imposition, which often involved warfare. And then I guess the second wave perhaps was the, you know, the reservation system, the residential schools, the people who, you know, like you're not registering you didn't register your children. There were people who fled maybe back into the backcountry or hid their children and kept them from the residential schools. That was obviously a form of resistance. And then I'm sure you know better than I, then various other waves, many of which are really unknown. I'm always struck by all the different various struggles and resistance movements that have popped up here and there over, you know, the past couple centuries that didn't really enter into, you know, history. Of course, not much entered into the official history. But anyway, you did mention, that's sort of a long lead up to, you mentioned the Native Youth Movement. I remember that kind of came on the scene during my sort of initial wave of activism or second wave, whatever. And that really struck me as a really strong, maybe talk a little bit about the Native Youth Movement, its origins, and I guess its impact on you.
Yeah, first I'd just like to honor one of my brothers, Horace, from Native Youth Movement OG, who just passed away the other day. And Native Youth Movement from around the world is grieving the loss of a great leader. He was such a great leader in our movement. And so just dedicate this little bit for Horace. Native Youth Movement inspired so much young people. And if you know the young people, the indigenous youth across the country is the majority. It's always been the majority for like decades and decades. Under the age of 25 is the majority of indigenous population across the whole country. And so at this time in 1990, when OCA, the standoff and with the Mohawks over land, over a burial ground, against a golf course that wanted to expand on burial ground, and really inspired the Winnipeg Native Youth Movement. Winnipeg was battling a really high gang problem amongst indigenous youth at that time, and Native Youth Movement recruited so much young people. It really sparked off Vancouver Native Youth Movement after when Gustavson Lake standoff happened, and it was always these hot times with conflict over land, indigenous people and versus Canada, that these youth movements, you know, sparked off. So Vancouver Youth Movement was formed after and during the Gustavson Lake standoff. And hundreds of young people, and this is when my youngest cousin, my baby cousin at the time, she was 15, she got arrested at the BC Assets and Lands, BC Treaty process. So they were fighting the BC Treaty, forced modern agreements to extinguish Indigenous title to land and be granted back fee simple and cash deal. Really bad deal. The government is trying to settle the unceded territories in BC with a really fraudulent extinguishment process called the BC Treaty process. And so there were some of the bigger movements of Native Youth Movement, the actions at the BC Treaty, and that's what got my attention as a young person. Well, that my little cousin was arrested, but also that Native youth were standing up in the hundreds in Vancouver. And it wasn't until like 2000, like 5 years later, that we're fighting the Sun Peak Ski Resort, and that's when we met Native Youth Movement at the 1 year anniversary of a land back occupation called Chuticash, stopping a $550 million ski resort linked with one of the Olympic medalists, Nancy Green Rain, and the push for the 2010 Winter Olympics venue site. And so Natives occupied that site, and even to this day they started in 2000 and they still have that land. They've never left, and they still have a home and village site there. It's called Chupacab. And so that's where I met Native Youth Movement, and I met Natanis Desjardins. And I'm saying these names because it's important to know the history of all of this, because she comes from a very strong family. The cousin of Horace who had just passed on, and the daughter of Cleo Reese, who actually helped recruit my dad into like some movements in Edmonton. And so we're all linked. We're still in it generations after. And it was the daughter of Cleo Reese that recruited us into Native Youth Movement, and up there at that Freedom Community at Chuticath. And they said, anytime you need help, we're going to send the youth, a part of Vancouver Native Youth Movement, to help with any actions that you need. And we said, yeah, we're going to do an occupation. we're going to do a government building occupation of the BC Assets and Lands Corporation building, the one that they're selling and leasing lands to Sun Peak Ski Resort and all throughout the province. So they said, okay. So they sent like two van loads full of youth, and we went into that office. They told us, they really taught us the ropes, because they were the ones doing the government building occupations and office occupations prior. And they told us, you know, what we all need, food, our sleeping bags, everything that we'll need for to being there and planning to be there for 4 days or however long we can stay there to get our message out. And end up being like 14 of us that end up getting arrested after 4 days, and them applying for an injunction enforcement order for the RCMP, and just starting to learn that the injunction process that they use to battle us and to remove us from areas, because in this case it was a building, but then they started using those injunctions on the land and start forcibly removing us from the land, which is genocide for them to do. And yeah, Native youth movement grew, and as we grew older, like, we started mentoring younger people in the movement, and it was really our chapter of Native youth movement that really started bringing the fight on the land, onto the territory, on the ground, and start taking back land and mm-hmm. start building homes on the land. And we built a cabin and we built a cordwood house, all both destroyed with the use of this injunction process. My father would call the injunctions illegal, Canada's legal billy club, you know, able to like just, you know, abuse us and fight us with a billy club and hit us back to the Indian Reserve, because, and that's some of the things that we didn't want to face off here in this fight as we're starting for land and against pipeline, is to have these tiny houses on wheels, because we didn't want to fall under their injunction process, which just really drained us during the fight at Sun Peaks with this injunction. And then even I was named on the injunction at the Imperial Medals Red Cross up in Talpan Iskit, Talpan Territory, Klibona Keepers, and David Suzuki's grandson. So I was named on several injunctions, and they're using these to like really force us off the territory, and we don't have, where else are we going to go but back to the Indian Reserve? And so this is, we've been here for 4 years. They haven't been able to remove us from this area where we are. But in the meantime, the past year, this man camp has pretty well been built a stone throw from my home and from where we established Tiny House Warriors to bring attention to the continued, you know, theft for this pipeline and just increasing.
You said,
you know, the Crown owns this pipeline.
Uh-huh.
The Crown owns this pipeline. You know, the Crown owned the residential schools. Like, the residential schools were built to remove us off the land. It's always been about land. It hasn't changed. The everything is built about, around land. Canada has come here to take land and resources to make themselves wealthy, to make their church very wealthy. They're one of the same. They're part of the same colonial apparatus.
And so
fighting both.
So needless to say, you haven't been celebrating, you know, Queen Elizabeth's anniversary of her reign in power and stuff. That whole issue of the continued relationship to the, you keep saying the Crown, it sounds very archaic, but there really is still, not just, you know, we talked about the Doctrine of Discovery, which was sort of the origins, the, you know, the theological, legal, justificatory, you know, framework for imposing, obviously it was imposed by armies and force, and then, you know, ratified by, you know, the demographic expansion of Europeans and the attempted genocide of the indigenous people. But the legal framework was from these ancient, originally Catholic, you know, well, it was before the Catholic Church split off to the Protestants, so it was just one church. Anyway, so that whole justification, but it's still, you know, the whole colonial apparatus is still right there, with the relationship to the crown. We do have a caller. I just wanted to sort of flag that if you want to say anything further about that, or we can just go to our caller.
Yeah, the crown is so deeply embedded, and they're the ones that they still say that this is crown land. We say it's unceded indigenous Tsleil-Waututh territory. They say it's crown land. And so it's us versus the crown. You know, when we face off, even when they just put somebody there, you know, to be saying this, but who is at the top? You know, this crown is so deeply, our fight is with the crown. And it may seem like you said, like, oh, this is like, is this back in like the back, you know, 500 years ago? Well, Canada just celebrating 155. You know, they're celebrating their 155th birthday. You know, so they're just a baby country. And so, yeah, we are still fighting the crown, and that's our big fight. And so it may seem ancient, but it's the real life reality of us right now, current day.
So I will just alert our listeners that you did use a word that we can't use on the air, so we had to X that out. So I'm not sure exactly how much of what you said got blank, but I think we got the gist of it. But I will encourage you not to do that again. Anyway, that's okay. So we do have a caller, and let's go to our caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Is that me?
Yep. Go ahead.
I just wanted to talk about the culture of Indigenous. My brother and I talk about this, and I want to mention that my son committed suicide, and I looked up on the internet and tried to figure out, and in Indigenous culture, it was almost never ever happened, because, you know, the tribe, it took care of each other, and that kind of, and also I also wanted to mention that the Indigenous culture, not only, you know, it wasn't about greed, it was about equality for each other and nature too. They vision nature as part of, you know, the whole system and everything, and I just wanted to bring those two things up, that I think this culture we're in now, the European white man, it's a train wreck.
Or worse.
Yeah, I agree.
And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that's really beautiful to share that, because we don't share too much about the beauty of our culture. We're always take the opportunity when we get a radio show to just say as much as we can about our plight for our people. But really, it's so we can have those times that we're with our family, that we learn so much, that, you know, language, like even within our language, recovering and reclaiming our languages and learning our languages are going to change a whole new mindset of how we are. Like my mom says, you can't talk about someone behind their back when you speak our language, you know, certain things like that. And then even just learning the words and seeing the stories behind, learning the word speechlum, one of our roots, and how this root is such an important chief food of our people. We actually call this a little person, and it's the chief of the roots. Even one of our Tsleil-Waututh, beautiful Tsleil-Waututh maidens married this root, you know, because this is who she fell in love with. And so we have stories like that, so we can continue to respect what is living on our land. The one time I was down in South Central at this school, and these kids around 10 years old speaking to them, and that one little boy, he put up his hand and he said, "Is it true that you natives, you think of the bear as your brother?" And I was like, "Yeah, it is. It is true." And then all those kids were like so fascinated, you know.
Well, you know, it's that's wonderful. You share that story. There's this term that was resonating in my head for the last few minutes, which is birthright. The idea that you know, we as natural beings, we have these rights to enjoy a free existence, freedom from coercion, freedom from kind of devastating impacts that are happening with this colonizing, expansionist industrial culture. But the idea of that you've obviously, as an indigenous person with a more direct connection through your family and through your stories to a time when you really did have that birthright, whereas, you know, most of us, it's like we have to almost force ourselves or read, you know, science fiction or something to get that feeling of being in a place that is what you enjoyed before colonization. And so I think that thought occurred to me.
Yeah, I think it's really important, I think, for everybody that's living here on Turtle Island, like here in the North and South so-called America, just the story that I have of going to the Unist'ot'en, going to the Wet'suwet'en territory. They've been fighting, you know, oil or the gas pipeline through their territory. And when you go to their bridge, because each clan is responsible for a certain geographical boundary of their territory within their bigger nation of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. And so the Unist'ot'en at the Morris River is where they're responsible for. So when you walk to that bridge, that they have their hereditary chiefs, they come out, or whoever's chosen from their nation to come out and to meet you, and they go through a living, breathing, free, prior, informed consent law that they've had since the beginning, which is who you are, you know, where are you from, like, and you're not just you physically, but your lineage and your ancestors from. Why are you here? You know, why are you here? And what are your intentions? And what are your skill sets? If we allow you to come here, how are you going to leave this area a better place than when you came? And so you have to answer that. And I had to answer it. And I was standing there with my husband at the time and my four children. And I had to really say, okay, what are my skills? How am I going to come onto this other person's territory? And then it's something that really you have to think as someone who has settled or some other race or ethnicity that's on Indigenous territory. That's something that we all have to ask ourselves. Like, even when I go to Vancouver, even when I go to other Edmonton, those are different people's territories. And we all have to think of that, because we're just sort of living on other people's territories, thinking we're so privileged that we can breathe the good air and drink the clean water, but never have a responsibility for the territory that you're living on, to protect her, to, you know, to look after her, to go pick up garbage, to do whatever it's going to be to leave it a better place than when you came. And that's what, you know, the Pope never did that. The church never did that. You know, these colonials for sure aren't doing it, because they're just destroying everything that we will need to breathe and to eat and to drink. So I think it's something that we all have to think about when we're on other people's territories. We do have skill sets that could benefit other people. Like, we don't have to go to other places around the world to feel like we're fighting for human rights. We have to just look in our own backyard to really find out what territory that you are occupying and living on, whether you're native or non-native. You know, we have to know whose territory we're living on if we're not living on our own, and respect that. And we have responsibility to that, not to the colonial governments by paying taxes, you know, by actually putting love and effort into the earth, into the water. And, you know, one person said, if we start organizing, if we've just focused, like, and people don't know where to start, focus on your watershed, because there's always stuff happening in your watershed that is being affected, you know, and affecting the drinking quality of drinking water quality.
We have another caller. We only have about 10 minutes left. So anybody who wants to call in, we may be able to fit in one more after this, maybe two, 503-231-8187. Go ahead. You're our next caller in the air.
Hi there. My name is Kawasi. I really, really appreciate you having Ken Hauser on. You're one of the most amazing frontline warriors that we're so fortunate to have on our side. And anyway, I'm hoping that you can talk a little bit about potluck culture and how the ability to give to others is the way of the people, and just the difference between that and how bankers interact. And, you know, the bankers are the ones financing these pipelines and taking piles of money. They're the ones who manipulate the crown. The bankers do this horrible thing in the name of finance. And talk compare that to how the people have potluck culture instead, because I think potluck culture, you know, is super important, and a lot of people could benefit from hearing about it.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, it was from 1927 to 1951 here in so-called Canada that it was the potlatch laws were in effect. So it was banned for us to practice our ceremonies through the potlatch ways. It was outlawed, and so that's really important to know that they didn't want us to do that. They would see us coming together and giving away everything at these big gatherings and potlatches and ceremonies, where our wealth and our value of who we are and what we valued was everything that we gave away. So our wealth, you know, pertained to how much we could actually give away to people. So we would have big, huge gatherings. Everything would be dealt with at those potlatches, like all the business within our family, our marriages, even our near-death experiences. When someone had a near-death experience, they would go there and announce it to everybody, and they would witness it, you know, and everything that needed to be witnessed by all the people. And you would do all that business in front of everybody. And it's the witnesses, the people there, that you would give everything away to. And you know, every other culture, all the other indigenous nations all throughout, from where I am, so-called interior, they'll call us interior Salish, and then all the way to the coast and the so-called Coast Salish territories. But we all have our own distinct nations within that, and just such beautiful potlatches that I've ever witnessed and seen. But it's very structured, and it's been in place for thousands and thousands of years, and it's where laws are enacted. Every business that's done, that you do, important political business, family business, is done there. But we all gave everything away. We gave everything away, and that was how we looked at and valued the most important people in our nation. Mm-hmm. You know, would be how much they could give away. And even to this day, it's a sad time when nobody gives anything away. Like my grandfather, he wrote that in his book, The Fourth World. He said when the first hunter came back to the village at Musqueamish and never gave any of that deer away and just kept it all for themselves, he said that was the mark of a very, very sad part of our culture being lost.
Well, that's capitalism, capital accumulation. That's the nature of this this sick economic system. Thank you for calling, Tuasi. We only have about 5 minutes left. I wanted to, I just want to say, you know, that is actually still practiced in a sort of a modified form around these parts of the native people. It's just called giveaway, but they often, as part of, if there's a death, or sometimes just as part of ceremonies, for various occasions, it's practiced, perhaps not as widespread and formalized and as deep seated, but it's definitely still there. Most of these practices continue in one form or another. I did want to. It really struck me that I'm talking to you, and we haven't spoken, you know, as I said, in these 7 years since you came to these parts in 2015, and it struck me that you're really not that far away. You know, you're a little up there in what's called British Columbia, but, you know, compared to, like, I have guests on from the East Coast of the United States who are quite a bit further. And, you know, this border between the United States and Canada, you know, we talk a lot about the Mexican border, and then occasionally people talk about the difficulties that some of the indigenous peoples have who always existed on both sides. But that kind of thing actually happens here too, and we don't really think about it that much. But obviously, I assume the ties between your people and there are ties between your people and people down here. And I just want to, you can talk about that, but it's also a lead in to a subject I really need to get into is what you're currently doing is organizing with indigenous fishermen on the coast of so-called Canada to fight super tankers destined for here, Washington, Oregon, and California, which kind of unites us all together. Maybe you want to talk about that.
Yes, we're taking our fight south of this medicine line to fight the tankers, the super tankers, the tar sand super tankers that are actually pumping bitumen through this pipeline I'm fighting through our mountains all the way to the marine terminal there in Burnaby, and they want to fill these super tankers with 890,000 barrels per day into these super tankers that they want to bring en route through all the inlets, all the way out through Port Angeles and out to Mia Bay, and then straight down through the Washington, Oregon, and California coast, all the way to the refineries in Richmond, California. And so we're uniting with people along the way. Anyone interested in collaborating or joining in on this fight, my email is kanahusmanuel@gmail.com. And just reach out to me. We're actually going to be building a 24-foot tiny house, warriors, feast house, commercial kitchen that will be movable on wheels to be the feast house to be able to feed the people in this call the people to people
in the indigenous communities to talk about the tankers and the impact that the tankers would have on the fishing communities as a way to unite with the indigenous fishermen. And have a stronger voice internationally against the tanker traffic on the coast. This is really crucial that we get organized, especially as Indigenous fishermen and women, since you know how it goes. It's always going to be the big greens and big nonprofits that end up really benefiting because they're raising billions.
Hello? Oh, no. Maybe we could, you could try to get kind of us back. That's unfortunate. Are you still there? Oh, you were breaking up. So you're talking about the nonprofits and the Greens who benefit by fundraising off of these struggles, whereas
So we just don't want to see those same things happen. We know that the tribal governments in the state, you know, can be really organized, and we've had several strategy plannings at Lummi, in Washington State, at the Lummi Reserve there with the Lummi people, and participated in some of the canoe journeys there, bringing attention to the tanker traffic impacts there, because one of the points there, Rose Point, is right where that tanker traffic is destined, and there's some very narrow inlets and some very areas of concern in and around those inlets, because there's just already a lot of cargo and tanker traffic out there already that we need to be very concerned about, because we don't want to spill in those inlets. That same salmon that swim out there are the ones that come up and spawn and give us food up in our rivers up into the interior. So all of the salmon is connected, and it's one of the focal points of the seafood, and why we're building this feast house in September is so we can be using this to bring around to people, to bring attention, but also a way for tiny house warriors to collaborate with Savage family and Anthony Fernandez and his family, as they're some main fishermen that has supplied us with so much salmon and trade, because our salmon has been affected right now in the interior because of the Mount Polly mine disaster. So yeah, trade and economies is important, political ties as well. So that's what we're uniting under, and just the sovereignty of waters, fishing waters internationally, that Indigenous people need to assert.
And of course, there was the Exxon Valdez oil spill, we all know, which was a massive tanker disaster. It's just a matter of time. All pipelines leak, and eventually there are going to be tankers that go aground. It's just a disaster waiting to happen. Go ahead.
And just to say, to note that this is bitumen. This is diluted bitumen. This is not the conventional honey oil, the oil that was in the Exxon spill. This is bitumen. This is similar to what happened in the Kalamazoo spill, still being affected even to this day because you can't clean it the conventional oil spill ways. The bitumen is heavy. It sinks. It's the consistency of peanut butter. It's thick. It's the most crudest oil out there. So
okay, I'm sorry. I got it.
Spills would be devastating.
We are right on at the end of our show, Kanahus. I just, since you mentioned it, I will repeat it. You gave your email. That's K-A-N-A-H-U-S Manuel. @gmail.com if you want to find out more. I'm sure the various activist groups and in this area that have been fighting the fossil fuel infrastructure will jump on this too. Anyway, thank you so much, Kanahus. It was great to hear from you.
All right. Thank you.
And bye everybody, this is Paul Rowland for Wednesday Talk Radio.
Pity the state and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights froze me. In jails, they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and leap on me.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m. Next up is Fight the Empire.